Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, Daniel Foster of National Review Online, filling in for Jim Garrity, who is, I'm sure, eating his fair share of Cajun food as he covers the Louisiana governor's race. Dan, first of all, happy Friday. Secondly, three major stories, which is kind of rare for a Friday. First of all, great news, another key terrorist is dead. Anwar al-Awlaki taken out by a drone strike, a Hellfire missile, as far as we can tell, with quite a bit of cooperation from the Yemenis, which is interesting given their own political upheaval and the fact that al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is pretty much based there. So I'm sure that's a very awkward relationship, to say the least, probably pretty close to what we're dealing with in Pakistan. But this is a guy, of course, who was behind the attempted bombing of the Northwest Airlines flight over Detroit on Christmas. He's the one who inspired the Fort Hood shooter, Major Hassan. He's the one who apparently inspired the attempted Times Square bomber, the UPS cargo plane printer cartridge bombing effort that didn't eventually happen, of course. So this is a guy who's got a lot of ambition, and apparently he has none of it left because he's in a number of pieces thanks to this drone strike. So great news. In a year where we've already taken out bin Laden and a couple of other important lieutenants, this is another good sign.
First and foremost, this guy was a first-rate dirtbag who deserved exactly what he got. He was also an especially effective al-Qaeda operator because he was American and spoke English fluently, and was able to recruit and radicalize, as we saw on a couple occasions, people outside the Middle East into potential al-Qaeda operatives. And there were some indications, although the intel that we seem to have gotten from the bin Laden compound might cut against this, but there were some indications that he was a more effective leader and plotter and operative in the broader al-Qaeda network than even bin Laden or Zawahiri were. So this is definitely a big get. I congratulate the president and the intelligence community. I want to thank the president for continuing many of the policies that he abhorred during the campaign that certainly led to this outcome. But we should also put a note of caution in this, even though it's the good martini, because I am a little conflicted. I sort of half agree with my colleague Kevin Williamson here, who very pointedly comes out against targeted assassination of American citizens. He thinks it's problematic that, you know, this was a due process assassination of a guy who was a U.S. citizen abroad in a non-directly kind of combat situation. Like, I don't think Kevin would have had a problem, and nor would have I had a problem if John Walker Lind, say, got shot while trying to shoot American soldiers. But the idea of a targeted assassination of a guy not directly engaged in combat operations, he's got a big problem with that. I'm sort of halfway there with Kevin. I think that it's a problem when you're killing U.S. citizens abroad without due process, but I think the easy fix there is to revoke his citizenship. And I don't think he would come back to the United States to challenge it in court. So I know it seems symbolic and formalistic, but I do think we should, as far as possible, maintain bright white lines between citizens and non-U.S. citizens. If citizenship is important for immigration, it's important for assassination. That's the way I look at it. But that's just a bit of pedantry. The good news is this guy's off the map.
Absolutely right. I understand the concern there, but I think when someone essentially declares war on a country that and uses massive explosive means to do it, that kind of limits the immunity when you're you're taking that position. So I think you and
he's
I are
a traitor.
Yeah, exactly right. So the other thing I think is a little bit concerning is I don't know what official the administration was quoted, but the quote after today's news that al-Awlaki was killed was, well, that means all we have left to do is take out Zawahiri. And the idea that if you just take out these people, the threat is over seems pretty simplistic. And you think after 10 years that that's not quite that easy.
It's like winning the war on drugs or the war on poverty. I mean, vigilance is the only way to win.
Exactly right. So anyway, America, once again, showing a strong backbone with the drone strike, good intelligence work to do this. But apparently, Dan, we're also a bit soft. At least that's what President Obama has told us in our second martini today in an interview with an NBC affiliate in Orlando, Florida.
I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do. And the way I think about it is, you know, this is, a great, great country that had gotten a little soft. And, you know, we didn't have that same competitive edge that we needed over the last couple of decades. We need to get back on track.
Good grief. You take away the man's teleprompter and he can't even spit out a sentence, much less. I'm sure you noticed the tremendous emotional passion he had when he talked about the greatness of America there. I know he was stumbling for words.
Greg, he said great twice. Isn't that enough for you? Not just a great country. We're a great, great country.
Exactly.
You know, we've gone a little soft. I mean, where to even start with this? Might it have something to do with, I don't know, an entire presidency based on the concept of hope, or subsidizing unemployment for 3 years, or spending a lot of time and resources worrying about bullying, or spending a lot of time and resources worrying about the food we eat, or massive environmental regulations that hurt the competitiveness of American businesses, or new entitlements that increase dependency on the government, or letting free trade agreements linger unsigned, unpassed, unenforced, and maintaining barriers to free trade? Could any of these things have to do with why he thinks we may have gone a little soft? This is the beginning of President Obama starting with a man in the mirror and figuring out what he might have done to contribute to this softness he sees pervading the United States.
I think that's right. I don't usually let Newt Gingrich answer questions for me, but I think his answer to this is pretty much spot on. Here's what he told a radio station once those Obama comments went public.
If you apply the Reagan recovery to today, you create 25 million new jobs. If you take the 4 years I was Speaker, the American people created 11 million new jobs. We know how to do this. It's just the problem we have is Barack Obama. That we don't have a problem of America being too soft. No, we have a problem with Barack Obama just being plain wrong.
And for all the reasons you outlined there, Dan, his big government approach, stifling business innovation and creation with tax uncertainty and regulatory uncertainty, and just this whole notion of government trying to run everything. And this is a good issue for, I think, all Republicans in the field to focus on. I'd still like to see much more focus on Obama than each other. And I know as you get closer to the real votes happening, you got to focus on each other. But they need to really keep the pedal to the metal on Obama. And I think,
absolutely, despite
the fact that her campaign is kind of spiraling downward, Michelle Bachmann's probably done a better job of that than anybody.
That's probably a fair assessment. And I think at this point in the primary, people are really concerned with pointing out the things that make them more electable or more desirable, depending on who you ask. But that's probably true. And Bachmann continues to be, not to sound dismissive, but she continues to be useful in the primary for that reason. I'd like to see Kaine surging do a little bit more of that. And I'd like to see Perry and Romney stop doing the war of press releases. Our inboxes are flooded every day, hitting at each other back and forth and focusing on this president. But one final thought, I do think that we could get tougher if only our kids ate healthier and were therefore free from bullying. They could grow up and work these green jobs. And I think that's how we're going to turn into a tough country that nobody's going to want to mess with. Have you seen the size of our solar panels? Who wants to mess with us?
Exactly. Gingrich also said this was Obama's version of the malaise speech. I'm not sure it's that pathetic, but it's in the neighborhood, and that's bad enough. So on to martini number three now. And Dan, you know, the president's been saying, well, really since even before he was president, but certainly in this latest pitch for his so-called jobs bill that even the Democrats won't pass, and Dick Durbin says they don't have the votes to pass in the Senate, much less the House, it's time for millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share. Warren Buffett doesn't pay taxes at a rate as high as his secretary. Well, turns out Warren Buffett's got a few different ideas on taxes and where this jobs bill should go than the president does, because speaking on CNBC a little bit earlier today, he was asked about the president's plan, and apparently he's not okay with just randomly raising taxes on everybody. He does want to see people like him, who essentially pay only the capital gains tax, have their rates raised to a level in equality with the middle class. But he doesn't want just people who make a lot of money, he said, like baseball players and TV stars, to see their taxes jacked up. So the follow-up from the CNBC reporter, Dan, was, so then you disagree with the president's call for anyone making over $250,000 to see higher taxes? Here's Buffett's response.
My program is to have a tax on ultra-rich people who are paying very low tax rates, not just ultra-rich people. And it would probably apply to 50,000 people in a population of 310
million. Okay, so but that means you disagree with the president on the $250,000.
No, you may disagree.
No, that means you do disagree, because if my public school math is correct, Dan, 50,000 out of 300 million is well below the vaunted and evil 1% that the president has thrown out there. Just saying.
When I saw the president trot out Warren Buffett as a supporter of his, tax hike scheme, I thought to myself, the last thing I'd ever expect Warren Buffett to be is a useful idiot. And he was appearing to be a useful idiot, but this answer encouraged me, and it doesn't seem like he's going to be a useful idiot. Look, he's making a legitimate point that that there's actually, when people bother to think about it on the right, there's actually disagreement about what should be done about it. What he's talking about is this kind of hedge fund loophole, this as you put it, the wealthy who make most of their money on capital gains. Now, people who made livings on tax-free bonds, they were the target of the AMT, the dreaded AMT that they have to patch every year. And the idea was basically legitimate in the sense that there are people who are very, very well off who are escaping paying basically any income tax because of the way they take in their income every year. But the AMT was poorly executed. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that Buffett's idea of patching this loophole, which, to be clear, guys like hedge fund managers work on what's called the 2-in-20 model. They get 2% off the top of what's in their fund, and that's taxed as regular income. But then they get 20% of profits that come out of the money that's managed in the fund, and that's taxed as capital gains. Now, the problem with that is the manager doesn't have any skin in the game. It's not his capital. It's his investor's capital, or it's very little of his capital, and he's making the 20% off the profits of everybody's capital. So incidentally, if conservative listeners out there are skeptical about me complaining about this, maybe all I need to tell you is that in the 90s and early 2000s, before the financial crisis, one of the biggest cheerleaders for this loophole in the entire country was Chuck Schumer, who went to bat for it time and time again because these are his constituents, these hedge fund managers. So you can disagree. Conservatives, I think, can disagree on the merits of whether or not those guys were doing the right thing by we're incentivizing those guys to take more risks by letting them take that income at the capital gains rate, or whether no, really they don't have any skin in the game, and so that should be taxed as regular income. That's a legitimate debate. Warren Buffett's taking a position on that. He's not taking a position on raising the taxes across the board on people who make over $250,000 a year. The president is, and Buffett took pains here to distinguish his position from the president's position. The former position is a question of fairness and of incentives and of the right kind of tax policy we want to have to encourage investment. The latter question is class warfare.
They're so unpatriotic, don't you think? I mean, he just doesn't want all these rich people to have to pay their fair share. Just so sad in a down economy that the people who have been so lucky and so fortunate, Dan, that have not been able to agree to pay their fair share, even Warren Buffett.
Yeah, well, he got all the way to the top because of everyone else, right?
Because
of what Elizabeth Warren said.
Exactly.
I mean, we raised him on our shoulders and elevated him to those heights, all of us together.
Exactly right. Dan, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
Daniel Foster of National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.